You are listening to the News Project for the week of May 20th, 2019, brought to you by GNAT TV. This week's episode features stories about a contentious proposed biking and pedestrian path in Manchester, how to digitize your old home movies, the future of brick-and-mortar retailing, which may lie in the experiences stores can deliver customers that online shopping cannot, an excerpt from an Arlington Select Board meeting in which they discuss strategies to get all residents to pay their water bills, and an excerpt from a Dorset Select Board meeting in which they discuss their town's own water woes.
More than 40 area residents jammed into the meeting room at the Park House at the Dana Thompson Rec Park in Manchester on Thursday evening to hear a presentation about a proposed bike and hiking trail that would run from the Manchester Elementary Middle School to North Road, and eventually, possibly beyond that, into Dorset. The project has been under consideration for several years already, as a group of local supporters acquired the abandoned rail bed of the Manchester, Dorset, and Granville Railroad, and have been gradually improving parts of it with the idea of eventually creating a trail good enough to ride a bike over, or walk, or jog, if that's the preference. The town of Manchester obtained a largely federally funded grant to finance a scoping study to explore the roughly mile-and-a-half stretch from Hunter Park to North Road that would include part of the abandoned rail line. If the project ultimately is approved and developed with state and federal financing bearing the majority of the costs, work on the project is unlikely to start until at least another year and probably even further away into the future. The pathway would be improved and graded and adequate drainage created. The meeting Thursday was a presentation led by Daniel Peck, a senior project engineer with a consulting firm hired by the town of Manchester, who described it and gave an overview of the project.
Intersecting Pigpen Run, going through this section of wooded area, through the field, and this is where the MD&G railroad corridor begins for the project, along this red line, up to this intersection with Squires Road.
Afterwards, it was opened up to hear community feedback, and of that there was no shortage, both pro and con. Supporters saw it as an opportunity to build more recreational capacity in the town for residents and visitors alike, but others, some of them residents and property owners who live in the vicinity of the proposed and upgraded trail, expressed concerns about privacy and security when a lightly used trail could become a passageway for a much larger number of people. The scoping study was only the first of more scheduled meetings on the proposed trail. Another presentation is planned for August, and then another in September, with the scoping study scheduled to be finished by late October. Should the project advance from there, a town vote to authorize the local portion of the upgrade would be needed, probably at next March's town meeting. Robin Werner, one of the members of the core group who have been working on this project for nearly 20 years, talked about its potential impact.
Rutland has a bunch of opportunities, including a mountain bike system that's fantastic. It's called the Pine Hill Park. People go there from everywhere. So biking is a good, or any kind of outside of activity is a really good thing. And this trail has, this, you have to understand, this rail bed has been here since 1903. Anybody whose property abuts this trail would have seen that railroad bed on their deed when they bought it.
We also talked with Donald Dykes, one of the immediate neighbors who opposes the project.
Exactly. It's just too close to our house. I look out my office window every day, and you can catch these people out of the corner of your eye, very close to our house. Any dog we see on there is never on a leash. Doesn't matter. Sometimes they come up our property, sometimes they don't. It's just isn't necessary to have the path, really. It's just a waste of money, I think.
If you want to watch the full presentation of the scoping study and the questions and answers that followed, you can find it at GNAT TV's website, gnat-tv.org. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Hey folks, it's Oz from GNAT TV. Today I'm with Alex from our sister station, CAT TV down in Bennington, and he's going to take us through this world of home movies. A lot of us have all sorts of home movies on many different devices. And the good news is that you still have this. The bad news is how are you going to get it off so you can see it in 30 years? So we're going to spend time just talking about this. Alex, this is a big one. I have one of these at home. Has my dad long gone on it. It's 8mm. This happens to be a Super 8mm. I've got a projector. I can watch it. I don't know if the bulb will last another 30 years. Okay, man, what the hell do I do with that?
So a good thing is you still have these, and another good thing is you can still get this footage off, whether that's, you know, you're paying someone, a company to do this, which they are out there, and a lot of them do this. The other option is, you know, like you were saying, your bulb may not be good enough, but if it is, I would absolutely project that onto a wall or a sheet or something and then capture that in a modern camera.
A lot of these are still around. I actually have some of these sitting in my house, the big old clunky VH tape. My understanding is if this is containing a home movie, the more I show my home movie on this through the years, the worse the quality degrades.
Yes, that is correct.
Is that true?
That is correct. And again, it's a physical storage medium, so some tapes will hold up better than others. At CAD TV, we've been going through some of these, and tapes from nearly 30 years ago, some are amazing quality, and some are nearly unplayable, and some are unplayable. Some have expired.
So then I have a machine that I can still plug this into that would, when I hit play, it'll show it. I guess the next question I have for you is, will I have a TV that could actually take the connection from the old VHS player 30 years from now or 20 years from now?
That seems very unlikely. We've seen a steady decline in the amount of RCA ports or the ports that a VHS player would plug into. Oftentimes, televisions just have one set these days, and that suggests to me in 20 or 30 years, they're going to have zero. You can have these get hooked up to a computer through a converter and things. It's a little more complicated, but it's not the end of the world if, you know, you don't have a TV.
Next up, it went from this to this, and this was a big invention, and I don't know how long it lasted, but same problem?
They still have that physical storage medium, that tape in there. So these do succumb to the same problems as the larger VHS. A lot of these aren't quite as old yet, so that's helpful. But one of the biggest problems is these never got as common as VHS. So it's unlikely that people just have a DV tape player laying
around. I don't
around.
At all. You're right. Right.
We were talking 20 or 30 years for these VHSs. I think within, you know, 5, 10, 15, you're not going to find a way to play these easily. That these are going to turn into a specialty company type situation.
So I guess we need to talk about the elephant in the room, which is the DVD. So here's what I did. You can laugh at me now because I think it's going to be all bad. I shot my old family thing against the screen, and I shot it onto this, and then I've recently converted it all to this, to the famous DVD, and I was really proud of myself. Okay, tell me why. I just screwed
up. Actually, it's very good that you took the initiative to kind of move this stuff along through the storage mediums.
It's going
to
be bad, isn't it? Go ahead, Alex.
But the discs are becoming obsolete as well. They're aging. Again, they're not as old as VHS or even DV tapes. Well, they've been around similar times, but DV tape has completely fallen off, whereas DVD is still sticking around. You can still go to the store, buy a DVD. There's still players and writers, etc. But again, this is a physical storage medium, and we all know that if, you know, that disc gets scratched, now it's unusable.
Right.
If it's not kept,
have a backup of it. Have a backup.
If it's not kept in a proper temperature, if it's hot and cold, it can warp the disc. Yeah. So many number of things. These are very volatile. I've heard people peg lives for DVDs at around 20 years. I feel like that's just a common, reasonable estimate for physical storage mediums, to say 20 years.
20 years.
VHS has been around for quite some time. I think we're pushing up to like the 40 year.
Right.
And again, we have tapes from 30 years ago that we're still holding on. A lot of times discs from 10 years ago, those are more questionable to me than a tape. I feel like a tape, if I have a player, it will play. A disc is a lot more question marks.
Let's say I've got a DVD, I know it plays, but in 20 years, will it, I may still have a DVD player that I kept because I was going to say, like, in 20 years, you'll be able to see it, kids.
Right.
But will that DVD player be able to plug into any kind of computer that's still in existence, or am I going to be...
I think that can depend on a couple things. One, the age of the player. You know, is it a more recent one? Did he get it at the end of the life cycle of when discs were prevalent, or is it more older, a bit earlier in the cycle?
Right.
Because that depends on the outputs it has. More often than not, a new one will have HDMI component right. and RCA, where some of the older ones just used to have RCA and component. And so... do I think HDMI is going to be around in 20 years? Not in its current form, but right. that at least future-proofs you a little bit. I would still recommend folks who have precious memories on DVDs to work on converting those into digital formats.
Right.
It's about the experience. That's a buzzword being increasingly heard when the subject of retailing and retailing's future comes up. Traditional bricks-and-mortar retailers have been grappling with the challenge from online sellers and e-commerce for some time now, and concerns exist that the future of retailing may well skew more online than in-store. But retail shops are far from helpless in the face of technology and online behemoths. They can exploit their in-store experience, the pleasure their customers obtain from stopping in and browsing and maybe buying, to offset what some may see as the convenience of shopping by mouse click, along with competing on price. What does all this mean for Manchester and other communities of Bennington County, where retailing is such a major part of local economies? We talked with several local retailers and people in the industry, as well as a consultant over in Saratoga Springs, to understand some of the dynamics in play right now. We started off at the Manchester Community Library, where we talked with Matt Harrington, the executive director of the Bennington Area Chamber of Commerce, after a conversation with a group of local retailers who were discussing trends in their businesses.
So I think obviously there's still some nervousness around online and Amazon, you know, being probably the prime example. You know, after this year, Amazon will account for 51% of all online transactions, which is kind of crazy to think about. But really, how do small shops and small businesses and retail shops compete with online shopping? A couple of the really interesting things we've heard and we've seen is really creating that customer experience. And I think there is still that want and need, and I think the retailers that we're here today were talking about that, which is I really, you know, people purchasing still want to know their clerk at their local store, or still want to be fitted by somebody from their local town or talk to somebody at that retail store. And I think what we've seen by some of the more innovative retail stores is doubling down on that experience. And so that experience might translate into social media and doing touch points along the way. That experience might be doing an event every so often for your customers and inviting specific customers to come in to know that they're appreciated. One person sends out $5 off cards with a thank you card to their customers. So we found that that businesses are small businesses in Southern Vermont are scrappy, and they're innovative and they're creative in how to get customers into their store.
We then headed over to Manchester's town hall, where we asked the town manager, John O'Keefe, to interpret the tax data that's being reported to the state and explain the activity that it was showing.
The past couple years of retail sales have actually been pretty flat, I would call them. We've had little increases or little decreases, but I think if you were to draw a line through all the points on the data, you'd actually probably see a pretty flat line. The one that we're seeing increase meteorically, you know, sometimes 10% over the same quarter in the previous year, is meals, rooms, and alcohol. So people are coming here. You know, we are seeing traffic. We are seeing people come visit, but it does seem like they're buying less things that go in bags, less retail. We've also seen some retail you know, it's interesting. You kind of divide it into two categories, I guess, is really an easy way to do it. One is competing with Amazon, and the other one is not competing with Amazon. So in a previous interview, I used actual Nature's Market. John, who owns the store, put a big investment in there. It's food. He's now moved into wine. You know, he's got various different baguettes, for example. So you can't buy a baguette on Amazon. So I think that side of retail, especially the food side, you've got the butcher shop, you've got Fortuna's, which has really interesting sausages and cheeses that you can't get on Amazon. Those businesses actually really seem like they're pushing the bar up. You've got other ones that may be competing more with Amazon. For example, it wasn't just here in Manchester, but regionally and nationally, Radio Shack went out of business. And I think that was a business that was competing really head on with Amazon. For example, a 6-foot HDMI patch cord at a store might cost, you know, 2 to 3 times more than what Amazon would ship it to you for 2 days. And your options would be greater. You'd have a 3-foot, a 6-foot, a 9-foot, a 12-foot, a 20-foot option. And if you're buying it locally, you may only have a 6-foot option. So I think that kind of store that's competing head on with Amazon does seem like nationally isn't more in danger than the stores that sell like a unique experience. Like another example that comes to mind is All Things Vermont on Depot Street, which is selling very unique Vermont products and New England products that people are buying.
So over we went to Above All Vermont to talk with the owner, John Moran, to learn about his secret sauce and how to compete with the likes of Amazon.
I don't think I can survive solely on Vermont, but I try to keep it as local as possible. I do believe a lot of people coming through here, and this is a tourist state, clearly, they want a Vermont experience. So they want local products, they want specialty foods from Vermont, made by Vermonters. And they respond to that. And we get a lot of feedback saying how wonderful some of these products are, because there really are some wonderful products. We also blend in other mix of things that balance out nostalgia, an old feeling of going to a country store. I wanted to replicate essentially what I had experienced when I was a kid. So when people come in here, they have what I would call a Vermont experience. It contributes to their whole trip up here and fond memories. I think it's important to take a look at what you can sell that meets a niche market that is not easily duplicated on Amazon or some of the other online stores. And then you combine that with something that's eye-appealing to people who come in. You give them great customer service. You go out of your way to make sure that when they leave here, they're going to tell their friends, they're going to tell their relatives, great store I just went to. And that in itself is your word-of-mouth advertising. Over time, it pays off.
Not far away, right on the heart of Main Street, sits Rathlogan Castle, which brings the Highlands of Scotland to downtown Manchester. There we talked with owner Robert Jones to get his perspective on Manchester and retailing.
One of the things that hurts the town is much of its advertising still promotes it as an outlet town, an outlet shopping. And yet when people get here, they find that many of the outlets that they were used to have gone. They find often, all too often, empty spaces. And so they then have to go searching for anything else. And they stumble across places like us, but unfortunately, because their preconception is outlet, they expect discounts everywhere. It doesn't bode well for a good retail experience. More than one customer has said to me recently, there's nothing much to come back to town for. And we actually tried online for 3 years, and it didn't work. Since we've gone bricks and mortar, it's worked very well. And it's because the product's unique, and the customer wants to touch and feel it. Amazon gets thrown at me all too often. My take on Amazon is that there is absolutely nothing wrong with Amazon, and Amazon is not actually damaging retail. The damage is being done by the consumer who wants to get cheaper and cheaper product, and by the manufacturers or vendors who choose to use Amazon as their vehicle. to make their life simpler. In other words, I guess we can look at it on both sides and say the manufacturers and the consumers have become a little lazy. But when it comes to us, I see us as a boutique-type store, and it really doesn't impact us. Our customers look for a higher-end product. They're looking for quality, and that's what we provide. And the one thing Amazon can never provide is quality one-to-one service.
Before Amazon got into selling almost everything that could be shipped from a fulfillment center, they sold books, remember? Chris Morrow, the owner of the North Shore Bookstore, explains what he's learned over the years about how to keep going.
Our answer, and I think this applies to other retail too, is to focus on what we do well and to focus on the experiential aspects of retail. Still, the vast majority of retail is bricks and mortar, and I think people are social animals still and like getting out and about, especially when they're on a vacation or at a resort area. So, you know, we need to stay up with technology, but also focus on the joys of the physical experience, and that ranges from customer service to the physical aesthetic of the buildings and the space, the bookshelves, everything, and of course, our booksellers, customer service, and our selection of what we bring in. We're not trying to compete head to head with Amazon. We have a different value proposition, to use a technical jargon. And so we'll see. I think other retail is in similar situations. They need to focus on the experience of retail. I'm a big fan of the festivals and bringing people in. You know, everything from the Rec Park, bringing in tournaments over there. I think that's a great idea. The Bluegrass Festival is a great idea. I hope that keeps going. Obviously, the horse show. So I think more of that type of thing that brings people here, that people get to know the area and hopefully become repeat visitors. I think that's important. If we can expand some of that into the shoulder seasons, would be great. And then I think we need to transition, to have an identity, more of an identity beyond the outlet phenomenon. A lot of empty space in town that needs to be repurposed and filled with interesting things, whether it's offices or other retail or housing or something complete, co-working spaces. I think the art spaces that have happened are great, but there's a lot of empty space in town that doesn't look good. So hopefully we can transition the retail outlook of town. I think the Depot Street project, I haven't really seen the latest renderings, but I think that will be great to have that big section of town, both more pedestrian friendly, but also more bike friendly, and more aesthetically pleasing with the trees and whatnot. So hopefully that'll turn out well. So I think the town is doing some good things to make the town more vibrant and friendly to shoppers. So,
for several decades now, shopping and retailing in Manchester have been synonymous with retail outlet stores. So we stopped by the Michael Kors outlet and spoke with store manager Gretchen Rothstein to get her takeaway.
I think the retail world in general is facing the competition of the e-commerce battle between where is the customer going to shop, online or in-store. In Manchester, I think we've faced the additional challenges of our tourism community, and there are so many variables there. If we don't have a great weather season, or if something else prevents people from coming to the area, that definitely has an impact on all of us. So I think that's two things that we face here, one that's pretty common in the rest of the retail world, and one that's a little more specific to Manchester. I think corporate companies in the retail world are recognizing more that we're going to have to give the customer an experience that they're not going to get from that computer screen or their phone screen. So marketing has a lot to do with it, analyzing the specific demographics rather than generalizing with something that's a little bit more of a blanketed marketing initiative. And then here in Manchester, we really focus on the customer experience and the personal relationships. So we want people to come back. And for us, our product isn't something that people necessarily need to come back once a month for, or even once every 6 months. So really giving them an experience that's going to bring us to mind when they have gift giving in mind, or even need, you know, a referral to another location or another looking for other products in our communities. I mean, I think we've all been there where we've ordered something online and it arrives and it's not quite what we were looking for. And then to have the opportunity to come into the store and look at the fabrics that are used and the materials that are used, and then to hear us speak to that also, I think is important to a lot of people. We need to change with the times, or we need to be moving forward with what the customer is looking for. I think if we stand still or remain committed to the old way of doing things, we're just going to be left behind. So I'm excited to see other brands and other designers, other stores in town, figuring out how we move with the customer who's enjoying a new way of shopping. So, I'm optimistic because as a consumer, it's also an enjoyable time to be seeing these new platforms available for us to shop.
And finally, to tie it all together, we travel to Saratoga Springs, New York, to talk with a consultant at Camoin Associates, an economic development firm, where we got the big picture view from Alexandra Tranmer.
Consumers have been really empowered over the last even 5 to 10 years to really understand where their products are coming from, how they're made, the ingredients that go into them, the labor that makes certain services or products. And I think that has shocked some retailers, and that's really affected what consumers are willing to spend their money on. Certainly coming out of the recession and people being cost conscious and, you know, really thinking about where their pennies are going, feeling like they can spend money on quality goods for themselves and their families has been important. I think, secondly, where we live and how we interact with our communities has changed. Again, in the last sort of 5 to 10 years, we've seen a return to cities, but even smaller communities that have a kind of urban feel but aren't necessarily mega centers. You've got your kind of small town where you can still run into the coffee shop and still, you know, meet your neighbor and say hi, but you've got a nice retail density and creates what we like to call a sticky experience. So you're not just going downtown for one reason, you're going down there for two or three reasons: meeting a friend, having a meal, getting some products that you need for home. It's really creating the experience and not just a good. You know, you're not just going for a good, you're going for the experience. And I think both communities and businesses themselves that create an emotional attachment to the consumer, if a consumer can feel an emotional attachment to, you know, what they're purchasing, I think that is extremely valuable. And something that businesses are still trying to figure out, and communities as well are trying to figure out how to connect to their residents, to their visitors, and how to really create that sense of place, which I know that you had asked about. That's a jargony planning term that gets thrown around a lot. But when I think of sense of place, I think of it as that distinct experience. You know, you could be walking on the street in Saratoga and not necessarily, you know, walking down the street that this is Saratoga, that's the ice cream shop that's Kilwin's, or Cantina, the Mexican place that's got the patio outside. I think it really distinguishes communities from each other because the truth is, you know, you could go down the street and get the same goods, probably maybe at a different, you know, a cheaper price in a different community. But if you feel that emotional connection to a community, you're likely going to choose to travel there over another one.
So retailing in the traditional bricks and mortar sense isn't going away, but it's harder to survive and make a profit if the game is simply business as usual. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
You know, the main point is to let everybody know, well, for instance, we've got an annual payment of $136,000. That's a fact.
Good, yeah.
And this is, you know, we need to have some income to ensure that we can pay the bills, and that's part of it. So we have most of the people pay their bills. We appreciate that, but they should not be held up, you know, for a rate increase down the road because there are people not paying their bills. That's kind of the gist of the whole thing. And we will start collecting. It's that simple, one way or another. So, look it over. What are your thoughts?
Should contact. Do you think we should say something like, look at your bill? You know, because otherwise they're going to like, well, I don't have that, you know, because that's something that's on their bill, if I remember correctly. And certainly when we send a special letter, we bring that to people's attention. I just wonder if there should be something about, you know what I mean? Do you know, on the second one, something about look at your bill.
I think if you have a past due balance, you probably know you have a past due balance.
I'm really not sure that's the case. I just think it would make sense to tell people where to find that out if they don't know. It's not a big deal. And then
do they not know how to read a bill?
People don't necessarily open their bills. Of course, they may not open this letter either. And I think laying out what we did, what the debt is, what we're having to pay is good, and then bringing up the question of it's not fair, I think that's really important.
And let people understand where we're at and where we're going. And,
that's right.
You know, we need to collect money or we're going to raise rates, and it's got to pay the bills. So we'll try to add something in there as far as your overdue amount. We'll be indicated.
I mean, and at some point we're going to be sending out letters again. I mean, I think we sent out some letters. Did we send out some letters?
Thank you. As far as no, this was sort of the first step.
Okay.
All right. Next step will be to actually pick out that 120 day list that we talked about, and that's the next letter. And
so is this letter?
Follow more.
So this letter is going to everybody.
Right, but is it going to go with their bill?
No.
It'll be a separate.
Okay.
Separate letter, and
sooner the better.
Thought.
Okay.
Maybe more after.
Okay.
Read it.
So the follow-up letter after this letter, is that going to be the you need to settle your bill by X date, or will terminate your service?
Yes, I believe so. I think that's the, you know, those are the, we've made the decision as to what the monetary amount is that we're going to start collecting on and possibly shutting down. That's the next letter that goes out.
Yeah.
I mean, this letter says if you've got a balance, please stop in. The next letter will say you have a balance and your water will be shut off if you do not stop in.
Right, and that's the one that we have to follow the state statute and use that letter on. I think it's pink paper, right, that they require us to send.
Yeah, there's a formal, letter.
It's in the appendix of the water guide for utility policy.
Yeah, okay.
And then beyond that, so if we have, let's just think hypothetically here, if we have users, we send the first letter out, then we send the we're terminating your service letter, and they don't respond, and let's say we terminate their service, what is our next step to still reclaim, or work to claim that dollars that we are owed even after the service is terminated? I don't know what the process is. Do we want to turn that over to a third-party collection agency, or is that just a lien on the property?
Personally, I don't think you'll have to go that far. If water is shut off, most of the time, and this is just most of the time, if Burr goes to shut water off, he has to post a notice on their door that it's going to happen with a date and time. Mm-hmm. And when he goes to do it, there's usually somebody there with a check or some money.
Okay.
So that is, the normal way that it works. I don't think you'll have to go much farther than that.
And then if it isn't paid, there is a lien on the property that would have to be settled at sale. And also, what else was I thinking? Oh, you can't get the water turned back on unless you pay everything that's due. So that kind of...
Okay.
And the reconnection
fee. Right, so if somebody buys the property, they have to pay everything that's due and the reconnection fee in order to get water service, and that amount should be part of the sale negotiations, but you never know.
Okay.
So, with a couple corrections here that have been talked about, is everybody comfortable with sending this out?
Yes.
I am.
Yes.
Okay. So we'll work on that one a little bit and get this out.
Which I called them, both of them, a 911. I watched them come down Madtown Road. If there were children playing in the playground, which they always are, if there was the concert was that evening at Dorset School, the children used it. I don't know if you saw the video of it. Mary Kilgallen was across the street. And there was big rocks, and there was anything that was in people's yard, a big, huge plastic container with kids' toys in it. St. Francis came from somebody's yard, and he's drowned in the culvert that didn't handle on Pleasant Street Extension, Johnson's old house.
Yeah.
So that culvert is not working. The other one, that's good that there's the bigger one up there before. So that's what I know about that. The culverts need to be maintained. And also, I agree with Jack about getting to the state and, you know, really see how we can mitigate this, because it could be much worse, as you can see by the volume on the map.
Yeah.
They call it the North Pond. The firefighters came, pumped out our basements. They did a really good job. It was May 8th, Wednesday evening. We don't want to see it happen again.
The first question, Rob, from Steve, was what can we do to prevent the flood that happened last week from happening again?
Did you talk about the lower and the upper ponds and all that stuff?
A little bit.
Okay, so the lower pond, Beaver Dam breached, and that's the lower pond is on two different private properties. The dam is on a singular private property. The whole area is wetlands. We talked about potentially trying to get a wetland permit to go in, if we can get permission from the lower pond owner to remove the beaver dam, physically remove it, but we would need a permit.
It's still there?
Well, it's partially still there, yeah. It's only a portion of it failed. And it's
so
actually
can
looks,
you make sure the portion that failed doesn't get rebuilt?
That would be,
since it was a natural occurrence that got rid of it.
To do it with a machine, you'd need a permit to do that.
Right. Beavers still there?
Do you need
anyone know?
What's that?
Are the beavers still in there?
I believe so. I think only a portion of it failed, and I think they've repaired it, and it's already starting to, you know, refill.
Who repaired it?
The beavers.
The beavers.
Mr. and Mrs. Beavers.
They work faster than the state.
So we are going to talk to one of the neighbors, John LaRue, who I've actually already talked to him, about trying to get permission from the landowner, if we can get a wetland permit to go in and try to remove, either all of or a portion of that dam. And we may have to do it a few times over a couple of years, hopefully to discourage them from rebuilding. And then the upper pond didn't breach. It's still intact. There's a file in the cabinet back from 96 when the last time this happened, and it was actually the upper and the lower ponds that both breached. According to the file and a few of the landowners, the upper pond, like half of it or three quarters of it drains south, and the other, the top like third actually drains north. There's like a high point in the middle of the pond. So it wouldn't be all the water, but certainly it would be probably more water than what came down out of the lower pond.
What's the status of the dam that's holding that right now? Has anyone looked at it? You've looked at it, right?
Yeah, so the Vermont Dam Safety Program has been made aware of it. I don't know that they've had anybody come take a look at it yet. I've asked a couple times. It's partially, it's a road, essentially. It's a man-made road. It's blocked up on the north side. There's a little stream crossing. Where the stream crossing was is where the beaver dam is, where the two ponds would connect. That's what's got the upper pond filled in to the level that it is. So that we talked with the town attorney, and that actually, because a portion of that's man-made and it's kind of a hybrid, under Vermont law, with something like a beaver dam that fails, there tends to be no, you know, landowner liability because it's a natural occurrence. With something that may be a bit of a hybrid structure between the dam, the bridge, and the beaver dam, it's a little different. That there's assumed maintenance with man-made structures.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.